Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jay Tiernan. In April 1997, after only a few months of being involved in hunt sabotage and environmental activism, he became well known in the UK animal rights scene when in a demonstration against a breeder for beagle dogs for vivisection, he climbed onto the roof of a building with one of those dogs, something he later went to prison for. A riot ensued, and another very violent demonstration a month later, and after another very violent demonstration a month later, Consort Beagle Kennels closed down. He became heavily involved in a variety of animal liberation campaigns until the summer of 2000, when a fellow activist was nearly killed during a publicity stunt he'd helped organize. The siren seems particularly important at that moment. At that point, he retired from activism, returning in the summer of 2012 to set up the campaign against the then-planned badger culls. As a spokesperson for the campaign, the bulk of his energy goes into using social media and working out creative ways to get into the mainstream media. The Badger Cull campaign has gone from a handful of people 4 years ago to now well over 100 active people on any single night during the six-week annual Badger Culls. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for inviting me, Derek.
So let's start by just saying, you know, who are badgers in the UK and what are badger culls?
Okay, so badgers, you have, I believe, a honey badger in America, so it's a similar, the same species. They are a nocturnal animal, so they aren't seen by people that much. We don't have that much in the way of large wildlife mammals. So most people growing up in the UK will see foxes, deer, rabbits, but quite a few people never see badgers. So they have almost a mythical quality to them. They're a protected species. They live in what are called, their homes are sets, their tunnels and chambers. And the badger culls, for a number of years, there has been, there was initially a link seen between badgers and cattle and a disease, bovine tuberculosis. It was seen that badgers had the disease and so did so the cattle. There was a large government-sponsored cull of the badgers which ran for 10 years through the late 90s and into the first decade of the century. That concluded saying that it wasn't worthwhile to kill badgers because where it was seen to lower the disease somewhat in the areas surrounding the culls, the disease prevalence increased. And this was through a mechanism called perturbation, where the understanding of it is that when you kill one or two badgers from a set, the rest then disperse, which then spreads the disease. That is in itself a contentious point. Some people say that badgers don't spread bovine TB at all to cattle, and that it's just a one-way transmission route. Farmers aren't keen to blame themselves for the spread of bovine TB. There was a huge spread of bovine TB after a disease, another disease, foot and mouth. There was a large outbreak of this disease in the UK. 2002, many millions of cattle were killed, and after they were killed, there was then a huge amount of cattle transported all over the country, and that spread the disease massively. So when you look at the graphs of bovine TB and its incidence, you see a huge spike around 2002. So the bovine TB is a problem for cattle farmers. The government wants to help them. They are lobbied by not only the National Farmers Union, but also quite a powerful organisation called the Countryside Landowners Association. And that's kind of like a club of big, rich, huge property owners who want to kill badgers for not just for the reasons of trying to lower the disease prevalence. Badgers are also they're very well accomplished omnivores. They gamekeepers. So one of the other issues with badgers is that on large shooting estates, there will be where pheasant poults are being reared for these large shoots, which are quite popular in England, badgers potentially will get in and kill a number of the young. So on these large shooting estates, they're very unwelcome. The badger itself became a protected species in 1992, and that was to stop the sport of badger baiting, where people would go into the countryside and dig into badger sets and set dogs on them. That protection of them also covers their sets, and because the sets are protected, so it's illegal to actually disturb a badger set, makes development on land very, very difficult if you have badgers on the land. So that's another reason why badgers, that people want to get rid of them if they're landowners, potentially they are stopping them from developing land. The current culls started in 2013. They wanted to start them in 2012. They were put back a year, kind of by activists. I don't know if that, I think I've pretty much covered the background of how we got to the start of the badger culls.
Well, yeah, everything you're saying is really great and really important. And let's back up a little bit. That what in the natural community of in the natural wild community of Britain, you said they're omnivores, and so what roles do they play naturally? Like who eats them normally, and you've mentioned that they eat pheasants. I mean, whom do they eat and who eats them?
So they will eat pretty much anything that's smaller than them when it comes to birds. So ground nesting birds. They're also blamed for the decline in hedgehogs, but they've lived side by side with hedgehogs for many, many years. The decline in hedgehog habitat is kind of heavily blamed for the population decline in hedgehogs. They don't have any predators, but some people will say that is itself a problem, that because they're an apex predator, that we need to control their numbers. But I personally don't believe that if we did have wolves, that wolves would be attacking badgers very often. They're quite strong creatures, and I think wolves would not choose them for their dinner at all. So although they're an apex predator, and there isn't anything out there that's going to kill them, I don't think that there historically has been anything that would kill them.
And how is the population trends? Do we know how do we compare the population of badgers now to say 100 years ago, 150 years ago? Do we know what those trends are?
No, we don't. But what we have seen is that the badger population has increased since the Badger Protection Act came in. But what we also see is that it levels off. They will live to a maximum density according to their food sources. Badgers, when they breed and when they rear their young, they can choose how many offspring they're going to have. So we would see typically a maximum density of, let me work out kilometres to miles, 2.5. So it would be maybe 12 badgers per square mile would be an average, but there could be as many as, possibly it could be as many as 20, and in some areas there won't be any.
So the next thing I want to mention is that, you know, you talked about the bovine tuberculosis, and if we presume, there's a couple directions I want to go with this. The first one is, if we presume for a second that it's not one way and that badgers can transmit it to cattle, let's just presume that for a second.
Sure.
It also is true, from what I've looked up, that they're not the only ones, that also deer and cats even have been shown to have the bovine tuberculosis. And there's even been some cases of cat to human TB transmission, but I'm not really seeing calls for cat calls.
Yeah, but in that's true. All of what you said is true, but the number of cases with cats to humans is very, very, very small, whereas the cases, the assumed cases of badgers to cattle by farmers is as much as 50%. They blame, scientists say that it's as little as 5%. The badger gets a lot of the blame because they share the same environment, and it's believed by farmers that badgers' urine is holding the disease, holding the bacteria, and then when cows go onto land where badgers have urinated, that the cows get it from that. But that's never been proven.
Well, I'll tell you my own bias coming into this, that I don't know much about the badgers and the possible transmission there, but the case I do know in the United States that feels very similar to me is that there are culls, if you want to use that word, of bison in Montana, because the cattlemen claim that the buffalo transmit brucellosis to the buffalo transmit brucellosis to the cattle, even though there's never been a case shown of this happening in the real world. And so what I'm trying to get at is the pattern of eradicating native species or culling native species to serve the financial interests of the farmers and ranchers.
Yes, I think that certainly is the case, and I'm not entirely sure that the that it will serve them financially. What we've seen so far, we see there are maps available. You can see all of the breakdowns of VTB. There hasn't been a lowering of the number of cases within the current coal zones, but from a political point of view, if we're to say, well, how are we going to lower the amount of VTB in the cattle industry, you have to do things that are actually quite painful to farmers. You have to decrease the amount of cattle movements, which obviously has an impact on business. And potentially you would be, well, a number of cattle are being killed, and so the compensation isn't as much as what they'd want, especially with some of the pedigree cattle. So the farmers don't want these heavier and heavier, what they see as punishments, but the government has to give it to them. So one scientist referred to it as basically the farmers need to be given a carrot, and the badger culls are the carrot that they're given.
Yeah, thank you for that. So let's talk about the actual process of the culls. How are the badgers killed, by whom, and then after that we'll start talking about the attempts to sabotage or to stop these culls.
Sure. So the method in the previous cull that was run by the government was just cage trapping, and then someone would come around and check the cages in the morning and shoot the badgers that are in the cage. That method is quite expensive because of the laying of the cages, the training of the people. So cheaper methods are wanted to do it. Now, the most preferred method by the farmers is gassing. That was ruled inhumane quite some time ago because the gas can't evenly flow through the sets. So the government offered the farmers this method of free shooting. So free shooting takes place at night time. Peanuts are put underneath rocks along the edge of a field. Marksmen, shooters will sit 30, 40 meters away, and then when the badgers come along to eat the peanuts, they are then shot. That method isn't a particularly effective method at killing a lot of badgers very quickly. And so cage trapping was also always... we were told right from the start that, yes, we would do some cage trapping, but maybe 10% of the killing would be done with cage trapping in areas where maybe it's not safe to do this method of free shooting. But what we saw in the first cull, in the first year, was the number of badgers that were required. There was a target number to be killed. They weren't getting anywhere near that target, and so in the six-week period, just 2 weeks into the culling, they started to deploy a large number of cage traps. And since then, we've seen around half, maybe 60% of the total number of badgers killed in cages.
And what, when you talk about total number of badgers killed, what how many badgers do they want to kill every year?
So they work out the number of badgers that live inside the cull zone, and then they say that they need to kill 70% of them. There was also this caveat that within the cull zone, 70% of the landowners must be signed up for it. And we actually saw through Freedom of Information requests that it was very close to 70% of land ownership was signed up. So you'd have like literally 71%, 72%, which basically means all of the people signed up, you have to kill every single badger to hit your target. So in effect, for us to stop them from reaching their targets, all we would need to do is to save a very small number of badgers. The reality is that the target numbers, when they failed miserably in the first year, they then manipulated the number of badgers that they said were actually in the zones and lowered them massively to make them look like they were successful. So in the first year, in the two zones, there was a total target of 5,000 badgers to be killed. That was dropped by the end of the cull zone. They said, oh no, you actually only need to kill 2,000. And we see that very much as a success of us, that lowering of the targets and a lot of lives saved, is just so that they can say, oh yes, we're effective, we've managed to reach these targets.
Okay, I'm not quite understanding their logic. When the buffalo are shot near Yellowstone, basically they're shot if they move from the park out onto other lands where cattle can be. But if you have, let's once again give them the assumption that there is transmission for a second.
Yep.
And if you have 100 badgers in an area, in some area, or let's presume that, you know, X percentage of them are infected, and you're killing random badgers, you're still going to end up with infected badgers in that area. That I don't understand what they're hoping to accomplish. Do you see my question?
Yeah, and lots of people that are against badger culling say exactly the same thing. What is the point of killing 70% of the population? Let's say 30% are infected, or you could say 50% are infected. Let's say, what difference does it make if you kill 70% of them? You're still left with this remaining 30%, and they, between 1 year and the next, will breed. And so the next year, you're potentially back to the same problem. It's a matter of politics. When you say, yes, let's let the farmers do this, and then when they do it, they can't do it, then they just kind of change the rules a little bit and say, oh, well, yes, look, you have actually, we'll change this, because we'll go back to the carrot. If you keep saying to farmers who are calling out for a badger cull, yes, you can have it, and then, oh, well, actually, it hasn't worked according to the standards that we wanted. Well, okay, let's just change the standards. That's what's happening.
So if we exclude the, well, we'll include the farmers. How is the popularity of badger culling across the UK? Is it a popular program or an unpopular program or somewhere in between?
Opinion polls have said that 80% of the British population are against badger culls. I think the reality is that if you asked 1,000 people, maybe 10 to 20%, if you asked them if they knew that badger culls were going on, probably only 10 or 20% would actually know that they are actually going on. So that's one of our kind of battles, is to make sure that people actually know about it. But if people are asked outright, do you think that badgers should be killed? 8 out of 10 people will say no, they shouldn't be.
And is this also true in the rural areas themselves?
I would have thought so. I think that it comes down to, it's very similar to fox hunting. It's something that the people who are proponents of it would like to say, oh, this is a city, you know, all the city people, but the rural people. And the reality is that when you go out into the countryside, you get a far more vociferous response from people when you ask them about fox hunting, because they see the fox hunts regularly themselves. And I think that that could quite possibly be the same in the countryside. A lot of people really like badgers. So I think the countryside people are more likely to have more appreciation of them because they're more likely to see them.
I've wanted to get this in somewhere that, that, you know, there's badgers in the US too, but I have been in love with UK badgers ever since I was a child and read Wind in the Willows. I wanted to bring in Wind in the Willows somehow.
Excellent. Yeah, I think that the anthropomorphism of badgers has certainly been of great value to them with regards to these badger culls. I think that they are held quite close to our hearts as a species. They're very iconic.
So before we talk about the actual attempts to stop the culls, there's another question I want to ask, which you brought up the fox hunts, and there is a tradition of fox hunting. And I know that the culls are given economic rationale, but is there, and I don't know the answer to this, is there a tradition in the UK of killing badgers, like you said, the badger baiting, or was there 400 years ago were people killing badgers just because they're kind of jerks?
Yeah, the badger baiting. Yeah, there was, I'm not sure when, how long a tradition it is, but it does still happen, just not very much. But are the people who are involved in badger baiting, is there a crossover to fox hunting? A little bit. The terrier men, the part of the fox hunting thing is foxes will go to ground. So quite frequently they will go actually into badger sets when they're being chased. So fox hunts used to be able to, they're not allowed to anymore. They used to be able to block up badger sets. And so the terrier men send down dogs down into badger sets to flush the foxes out. So that would be where you would get the crossover. But I must say that I don't think that the killing of badgers as a sport, I don't think there's very much of that. I think there's certainly people, there certainly are people who are involved in these badger culls who do it. And perhaps some of the most committed ones who go out shooting at night time, they are doing it because they enjoy killing.
Walk us through a badger call that is sabotaged on the ground. We'll talk about other tactics later, but how do the people trying to stop them, how do they interfere?
So firstly, in the run-ups to the badger calls run for 6 weeks. In the months running up to it, time is spent working out the location of all the sets. So people have to walk across all of their hundreds of square miles of area and map out where all of the sets are. And then when it comes to sabotaging badger calls at night time, when the shooters are out at bait points, it's a question of potentially having found the bait points during the day, and then putting some kind of, like an ante, the sort of thing that you put down on your garden to stop a cat coming, or maybe urinating on them. They don't like male urine. That might keep the badgers away from the bait points, but the bait points aren't particularly easy to find. So what we found in the very first weeks of the badger call, and I must say that when we first started this, we weren't sure that we would ever find any shooters ever. The concept of us finding people out at night time, we just didn't think we'd have a chance. But what we found in the first, very first few days was that the people who were trying to kill the badgers used infrared lamps. So they would light up an area with infrared lamps, invisible to the naked eye, and that would allow them to see an area where they could shoot over using their night vision scopes. We had very, very cheap night vision monocles. I'm talking like $100. And with those, we could then see, maybe just into the next field, but we could see this huge amount of light that wasn't there to the naked eye, and that gave away the locations. And as soon as we realized that we could find them using night vision, we immediately fundraised. We used crowdfunders, and now we have military grade, some of the best night vision available. We also have thermal imaging equipment, and then we would get into positions where we can see over an area and look for these infrared lights or look for shooters, or it may be that we know where a shooter lives, or it may be that we recognize a shooter's vehicle and we follow them. And then once we've seen where they are or where they're going to, we basically have to get into that field, and their guidance protocols is that as soon as they see us, they pack up and leave. So they don't want any interaction with us. So we, you know, this idea of kind of us facing these people with high-powered rifles does sound a little bit scary, but there's really nothing to it. You just have to turn up, get into the field, turn a torch on, say, yeah, we can see you, and they pack up and go. Daytime work is a completely different thing. It's about finding cages which are normally put around the sets, the homes. Sorry, I said homes, where the badgers live. And on neighbouring runs, so where the badgers go through maybe a hedge, you'll see kind of a break in the hedge, and there'll be a cage there, and they're baiting with peanuts. We then, once we find the cages, we there's a kind of method. You put them, you angle them up slightly, you open the cage door, and then you jump up and down on it, and you can usually flatten them with three or four jumps. That renders them broken, and we just go on to the next one. So that element of knowing where all of the badger sets are is absolutely crucial.
Does it ever happen that people find trapped badgers and release them?
Yeah, that happens. During the culls, we'll probably get video footage of that 2-3 times a week.
So what is the relationship to the police of all this? Do the shooters, I realize they go, but then do they call the police to get you for trespassing, or?
That's the policing element of this has always been very peculiar to us. What we expected in the first year was that we would face mass arrest, and then we would have bail conditions, and that the bail conditions would keep us away from the area for a few months until it had finished. But something unusual happened, and that unusual element is the middle, what we refer to as the Middle England people. The Middle England people are your quite frequently middle-aged professional people who don't do the trespassing. They don't jump up and down on the cages, but they formed these wounded badger patrols. So they just stick to the footpaths, and they act completely within the law. Their involvement, along with a lot of celebrity endorsements against the badger cull, has seen the police behave very even-handedly. They said they're behaving even-handedly, and they're not as even-handedly as they could be, but a lot. They're a lot less keen to arrest us than we thought. So we've had, for the trespass, there's a criminal element of trespass called aggravated trespass. We've only ever had two people in 4 years convicted of that.
That's great.
Yeah.
So I hate to ask because of the whole celebrity culture, but who are some of the celebrities who've come out against us?
Okay, so this element of celebrity culture is something personally, I don't like celebrity culture, but we have used it very effectively on social media campaigns. What we find is that when we put up a little picture of a celebrity with their quote against the badger call. But that brings a lot of interest to the page, which in turn helps us recruit and get financial support. So it's quite it's a bit of a sellout, but it's something that has worked. So who?
Any tool in the toolbox.
Yeah. So I could just... So I think probably the best... the most famous would be David Attenborough. He's a very famous English wildlife presenter. But lots of pop stars, you know, the usual suspects like Morrissey. Brian May from Queen. He's very outspoken on the Badger Calls. He's brought a lot of press coverage. Anthony Head, do you know him from Buffy the Vampire Slayer? I'm just looking at a list now. He's one. There are a lot of TV actors, British TV actors, which you may not know, and TV presenters, models. So, yeah.
That's great. So you mentioned earlier, you mentioned in your intro that it's gone from a handful of people only 4 years ago to over 100 active people on any night. That's an extraordinary change. That's an extraordinary growth. And to what do you attribute that growth?
I would attribute it to the Middle Englanders. Their interest in it. I think that we had these badger calls before in the country, and I think a lot of people who would have spoken out against it didn't, because it was pushed as let's see what the science says, let's see if badgers are responsible. And I think when that had finished, it was some years ago, that then gave a lot of people a lot more confidence in speaking out and agreeing that yes, the badger calls were wrong. So perhaps people that previously who would have been jumping up and down on cages wouldn't have seen that support from the Middle England badger groups, or someone from, say, the RSPB, which is the Protection of Birds. And now that's changed. In the run-up to these calls, we had a lot of press about it, and we had a lot of scientists speak out against it. And I think that that kind of validates that the badger calls are wrong. And I think that that validation has helped. But also, I think in the first year, in 2012, we got a lot of press. And the calls didn't start till 2013, but they were supposed to start in 2012. And at that point, there was very, very few of us. There was literally handfuls of us. But the badger calls were cancelled that year. And it was said that they were cancelled because they couldn't police them, because the police were overstretched from the Olympics, and that they couldn't then go on to police a badger call. And the reason that they couldn't police badger call was because they perceived that there would be potentially hundreds of us. At that point, we wouldn't have been able to muster more than maybe five or six people a night. But the perception that we were actually a lot larger in number then gave us a lot of power. People perceived then that we were actually quite a force to be reckoned with. They had faith in us that when the badger calls did start, that we would be able to stop them. We, as I said earlier, we privately didn't think that we had a chance of stopping free shooting at night time, but we always presented that we would do our best and that we would be able to stop them. And I think people had faith in that confidence, and they joined in. And then as soon as the call started and they could see that we were stopping people from shooting at night, I think that that again gave us another surge.
So later I want to ask how people can help stop the badger calls. But right now, I'd like to ask you, everything in my work is aimed at getting people off their butts and doing something. And what can someone in upstate New York or in Denmark or in Florida, you know, for their own campaigns, what lessons can they learn from this process of this explosion? Well, I'm going to back up a second. And I live in far northern California, which is known more than anything else. Well, it's known for two things. One is salmon and the other is marijuana. And we can grow marijuana legally here. And the county where I live was going to drop the number of plants you can have from 99 down to 6. And when the government, local government people tried to do that, the place was packed with basically medical marijuana patients, with potheads, with everybody saying, no, we won't let you do it. And that was a great example of participatory democracy in action. But the thing that broke my heart is that if this were about the salmon, there would have been 5 people show up. So how do we get, what lessons do you have to teach other people, to help other people to have campaigns have this level of success?
Some of it is down to things that are completely out of our control, and that in part is the outspokenness of the celebrities. We haven't had really anything to do with that. That has helped us a lot. But I would say that the working site, by having a two-pronged campaign, we looked at really early on, we could see that there were these people who wouldn't be as active as us. They would not jump up and down on cages. They would not, they had too many potentially responsibilities in their workplace, or they were scared of being arrested for whatever reason. And we needed to work out how could we find something for them that would be effective. And without directing them, we quickly met them in public meetings. And then in public meetings, we helped to facilitate really early on, because we had the organizational skills, help them to just work out those public meetings that they needed to have, to just guide them very gently. And then to keep communication between the two groups good at all times. And that goes on through the Coles itself. And by having these two distinct groups, it allows people who are prepared to undertake something that might be illegal to be separated from the people who aren't. And it may be that all outsiders can't see that separation. But that doesn't matter. The people who are going about their business and doing it lawfully feel, yes, I'm doing it like this. I'm not that group of people. What we found, the problem that we found is that the patrols, the lawful patrols, went from, in the early days, we had large numbers of people on them, and those numbers dwindled really very rapidly. Within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, we went from 70 people down to sometimes 10, 15 people. And those people that were there in number just basically all came over to our side. They realized that they could get away with jumping up and down on cages. They could stop shooters. They just needed a little bit of a comfort zone where they were encouraged, supported, and not felt to be in any way lesser. And they're not lesser. What they do is invaluable. To have a group of people walking the countryside who are beyond reproach, it has been vital to us.
I think what you're saying is absolutely crucial. And I used to teach at a university, and I would often suggest that my students, if they showed an interest, I would suggest they go work with a local environmental organization. And the local environmental organizations often didn't have anything for them to do because the training, they didn't know that they would be committed, and they didn't want to take 10 hours to train somebody who's never going to show up again. So how did you get somebody, walk me through, somebody calls you or emails you or calls somebody or emails somebody and says, hey, I want to be one of these, I'm sorry, I forgot the name. I want to be one of these walkers, the people who walk down the paths.
Patrollers.
And how do you then get them, how do you help them to take that first baby step? What process do you do that doesn't waste your time if they don't ever do it, but at the same time encourages them?
So the patrol groups, we just worked on setting up. We worked on helping to facilitate those patrol groups set up as groups really early on. So those patrol groups were being set up to a year beforehand. So we were lucky to have that gap of the year before. As I said, it should have started in 2012. It didn't actually start until 2013. So those Wounded Badger patrols at the time, there were two areas were set up and had organisational time. They had their meetings. And so we didn't have to do very much. We just had to be there right at the inception. And once they got going, they worked under their own steam, and that was fine. So now if someone comes to us and says, I'd like to be one of those patrollers, we just direct them to that group. And we have actually got now a central organisation that is kind of a catch-all for absolutely everyone. It's just basically a website. It's the Badger Action Network. And you can just send anyone to that website. And if they're interested in getting involved in the Hunt SAB groups and you know, going out at night time and jumping up and down on cages, or if they want to be patrollers, it doesn't matter. You can send anyone to that website, and then there's someone sat on that website, and then they work out, okay, you're in this part of the country, so you should be with that group, and they just literally link the two up.
And for the patrollers, basically all they're doing is taking a very nice walk through the afternoon, right?
Yes, and in Gloucestershire, there was a very large number of, there's far more urban population surrounding the coal zone, and so there's a lot more locals involved in the coal there, and some of the people didn't have the ability to do these walks, and so they would sit in deck chairs on footpaths, and some people would sit in their cars just on a crossroads or near a field entrance, and we found that that was very empowering to be able to say to anyone, look, it doesn't matter what your ability is, we will find something for you to do, and it will be effective, and we won't push you out of your comfort zone, you will be effective, you will stop people from killing badgers.
That's so great. So we have about 5 minutes left, and first, how can people, both who live in the UK and people who don't, how can they help how can they help both your specific efforts and the larger efforts to stop the cull?
Our specific efforts, well, as I just mentioned, there's badgeractionnetwork.org.uk. If they go into there, they can contact them, and then through that they can find groups or transport if they're in another part of the country. Outside of the UK, you could help via Twitter or via social media. So sometimes we are doing, I'm thinking of the roles people could, you could help with just by spreading a crowdfunder. That would help, but also sometimes we put out information on people who are involved in the cults, and by putting that information out there, what we hope to achieve is to deter those people from being involved, and that is something that anyone could do anywhere in the world. You could just by retweeting or like, oh yeah, I can see this post here about this guy, I'll share it to another group. Those kind of things help from a social media point of view. We do have people who travel. We've had people from America. We've had people from, I'm just trying to think who I've met this year, people from Holland, people from Germany, people from Scotland, isn't another country, but it might as well be for the distance it is. So people do travel. And we have camps in each of the zones. So we have places for people to stay. All of the kitchens in all of the camps are vegan, but there is no emphasis on people being vegan. We just say that the kitchens are vegan. We don't have a strong emphasis on it's an animal rights campaign, but we don't particularly push veganism. Many of us are, but we don't feel that by pushing veganism, it would particularly help the campaign. What we need is more people, and I think most vegans anyway know that if you want to get more people to be vegan, that telling them what they should or shouldn't be doing isn't the way to do it. It's far more effective to just talk about your veganism if people ask, and providing food. Providing food is one of the big things. A lot of people have a misconception that vegan food will be awful. It will be, you know, like a lentils or something. So having these vegan kitchens helps. So yeah, if people want to travel to the UK, they will be well looked after and catered for.
And how is this a how do the finances work on this? Is this a shoestring budget, or is this something that there are some significant grantors for?
No, we don't get grants at all. It is a shoestring, but although we have a very hand-to-mouth existence, we have a lot of supporters, and we found that crowdfunding worked really well. So we have got, I think at the moment we've got, it's got to be close to £100,000 worth of so that's like $130,000 worth of equipment, just in the night vision and thermal imaging and stuff. And that's all been crowdfunded. And some people we have had a few people who've bought us stuff and asked for it back through the rest of the year to do wildlife projects with. But yeah, the direct action side of it is not very well funded.
So we have like 2 minutes left. Are there any other things that you want to tell people about either badgers or the badger calls?
I would say that the one thing that has been a great help to us is that the organisation that was already there is the Hunt Saboteurs Association, and these groups are local groups all over the country. And those groups kind of declined a little bit after the banning of fox hunting in 2004. But they've had a huge level of support through the Badger Culls, and a lot of them have got involved. And they're an organisation that have been going since 1963, so they're 53 years old. There's a lot of very experienced people, and I don't think that we could have done it without that kind of backbone, grassroots, direct action organisation.
So it's very important to, and one of the things I'm getting from all of this is just the importance of organization and the importance of having means by which new people can join at whatever level of involvement for which they're comfortable.
Absolutely. It's absolutely essential that anyone who comes to us and says, I'd like to do this, they're not... That no one's work is more important than someone else's work. That's absolutely vital that we find work for everyone. We have people who can't walk, who do very effective work, and they are cherished.
Well, that's really wonderful, and I would like to thank you for your work and for being on the program, and I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jay Tiernan. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.